This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. When Donald Trump was campaigning, he often condemned journalists for lying, for being disgusting people who reported fake news. Sometimes he'd single out one reporter for criticism.
There's something happening. They're not reporting it. Katie, you're not reporting it, Katie. But there's something happening, Katie. There's something happening, Katie.
She's back there. Little Katie. She's back there. What a lie it was. No, what a lie. Katie, turn. What a lie it was from NBC to have written that was a total lie.
We're going to talk with Katie Turr about what it was like to be jeered like that while she was doing her job. Katie Turr covered Trump's campaign for NBC and MSNBC and was the first national TV correspondent to cover his campaign full time. She's written a memoir called Unbelievable, My Front Row Seat to the Craziest Campaign in American History. She's now an MSNBC anchor as well as a reporter for NBC. Katie Turr, welcome to Fresh Air. Describe the first time Donald Trump, candidate Trump, called you out by name at one of his rallies.
Well, thanks for having me, first of all. And the first time Donald Trump called me out at a rally was the very first rally I ever went to. It was June 30th, 2015. It's around a backyard pool at a private home in New Hampshire. And I am this brand new, I guess you could call it, political correspondent. That morning, I was assigned Donald Trump full time. And I sped up there from New York to New Hampshire, driving there when a normal person, any political pro, would have flown. I just make it to this rally. It is raining. It is an awkward, curious event. And I'm standing there writing down what he's saying on my phone, tweeting some of the things that he's saying as well, when suddenly I hear my name. And I don't look up because I presume he's not talking about me. And my producer nudges me hard in the side. And there he is. He's pointing at me, looking at me, and so is the entire crowd and all the other reporters. And he says, Katie, you're not paying attention. And I looked at him and I yelled back out, I'm tweeting what you're saying. To which he seemed happy to hear. And that was the beginning of my interaction and my relationship with Donald Trump.
Okay. And then subsequent times he called you out in various ways, as we've heard. And then once he told you to be quiet, describe that time.
So that was, I believe, July 27th, 2016. And this was a press conference that he was holding in the middle of the Democratic National Convention. He had just won his own nomination at his own convention. There was worry that the Republicans might try to take it away from him. And normally, in a normal presidential campaign, the whoever has their convention first kind of goes underground during the other person's convention so that they can allow them the spotlight for a few days and they can regroup. They can watch. Donald Trump didn't do that. There was no reason to expect that he would do anything in a normal way, obviously, at this point. But instead of just allowing Hillary Clinton the 3 days of her convention, he takes the podium in Doral, Miami, at his golf course down there, his golf resort, and holds this freewheeling press conference, as he tended to do from time to time on the campaign. And in it, he called on Russia to hack into the emails of Hillary Clinton, find her missing emails. Remember, emails were the one thing that he could really ding her on that had legs during the campaign that people didn't want to let go of. And I raised my hand and eventually just started calling out questions. And he looked at me and I said, doesn't it give you pause? Doesn't it give you any pause to ask a foreign government to interfere in our election, to get into the emails of any citizen in this country, let alone Hillary Clinton? Doesn't that give you pause? And he tried to steamroll me and not answer the question. And I kept pushing. And he eventually said, be quiet. I know you're trying to save her, in reference to Hillary Clinton. And I remember it rolling off me because this is Donald Trump and I had dealt with him so much by this point. And it frankly was not the first time that he told me to be quiet. He had told me to sit down at other times too, but these things weren't broadcast on national television. And I just kept asking, and he finally answered the question and said, no, it doesn't give me pause.
So that was at a press conference. When he was saying insulting things to you at rallies, what got the biggest, angriest response? Angry at you, not at him.
Definitely December 7th, 2015. This was a rally in Mount Pleasant, South Carolina. It was the day that he announced that he wanted to ban all Muslims from coming into America. Even Muslims at that point during the day, Muslims who might have been serving overseas in our military, Muslims who might have been overseas visiting friends or family, Muslim athletes who might have been, at a match or a meet overseas, anybody, where there were questions about all sorts of well-known people that might not be able to get back into the country. And this was a real turning point in his campaign. It was a real test of whether or not his support would stick with him. We hadn't had any primaries yet. Nobody had voted, but he was getting these massive crowds, and he was being excused for anything that he said. And this was a test. Will his supporters condone him going after an entire religion? At the time, San Bernardino had just happened a week or two before. People were scared about terrorism. This couple had gone into an office party and shot it up and killed a number of people. And Donald Trump was saying that the administration in power, the Obama administration, was doing nothing to protect Americans, that they weren't vetting people properly, that they were putting your life at risk. Your family and your sons, your daughters, your wives, your husband, your grandparents are at risk every day because the Obama administration is not protecting you and the media is complicit in this. So they're not only angry at Washington, they're angry at us, the journalists. And this was one of those rallies where I felt like it was good to keep a lower profile. So I sat down on the stage, not the stage, the press riser. I wasn't standing up in front of my camera. I wasn't easily seen. I was just sitting, taking notes as he was talking. And we're waiting for him to announce the Muslim ban. He doesn't get to it yet in the rally. And suddenly, just like the first rally, I hear my name, Katie Turr. She's back there. Little Katie, what a lie it was. What a lie she told. And he's pointing at me in the crowd. The entire place turns and they roar as one. I write like a giant, unchained animal. And I just see men standing on their chairs and yelling at me. The only person, the only friendly face in the crowd that I could find was this older lady who was right up, pressed against the press pen, who looked at me horrified for my safety. And I just remember thinking, smile and wave. Because if you smile at them and you wave, I had learned up to this point, then you diminish the tension. You diffuse the situation, you mitigate it. Because if you look intimidated, if you look scared, people will take advantage and people will push harder.
So he'd often call you Little Katie. How tall are you?
I'm 5'2", 5'3", on a good day.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what did the little say to you? And I'll point out, it's little Marco also, isn't it?
Yeah. And what's interesting is Marco Rubio. Marco Rubio is quite tall. I am much shorter than Marco Rubio. I think he means it not only in a physically demeaning way, but in a, as an intimidation tactic. You're little, you're young, and you're inexperienced, and you can be pushed around. You're not a political heavyweight. You're not one of the big guns. I presume that's sort of how he means it. But he's also a very literal guy. When he sees someone who is little, and I am little, I think he is apt to say just that, that person is a little person.
It's kind of like, oh, you're little and adorable and totally powerless.
Yeah.
So then there's the time he kissed you when you were both getting ready to appear on Morning Joe. And this one, they were doing their show live from, it was a restaurant or a bar.
Yeah, so this was New Hampshire, and it was early on in the campaign. I think it was November 11th, 2015. It was right after the Milwaukee Republican debate. And I am there in New Hampshire. I had just done a hit on Morning Joe. And the question that Mika Brzezinski asked me was about why Donald Trump was changing his tone. Because he was nicer in that debate than he had been in the past. The week prior to that, he was going after Ben Carson, suggesting all sorts of things about how fit Ben Carson was for leadership and to be a presidential candidate in a bit of a nasty way. And so I was talking about his tone, and I guess I came off as relatively generous toward Donald Trump compared to my previous reporting, because Donald Trump walks in and he barrels in, and the first thing he sees is me standing off to the side, and he comes right up to me and he kisses me on the cheek, just puts his hands on my shoulders and pulls me in. Before I could do anything, I was powerless. I just stood there frozen, thinking, oh my God, what is this man doing? He's not my friend. He's not my business partner. He's not a social acquaintance. He's not a family member of mine. This is somebody I am covering. This is a presidential candidate. I am the reporter assigned to this beat. That is just it crosses a huge line. It's so unprofessional and so inappropriate given the circumstances. I remember being horrified that a camera caught it and that, you know, my bosses back in New York would see it and they'd think that I was not a serious reporter and that I was too close to this campaign and I couldn't report accurately or fairly about him, or that viewers might think that. And I panicked. I went and I found one of our senior producers for Morning Joe, and I asked, you know, did you catch that on camera? And he said, no, we didn't. And I remember breathing a sigh of relief and then hearing Donald Trump brag about it on the air with Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski.
Yes, well, let me stop you there. Let's hear what he said on Morning Joe. So here's candidate Donald Trump on Morning Joe.
One of the folks said some really nice things about me this morning on someplace, and yeah, it didn't happen to be here. But actually, Katie Turr, what happened? She was so great. I just saw her back there. I gave her a big kiss.
Really?
She was fantastic.
Okay.
But on one of the...
I don't even know what to say about that.
So what was your reaction to hearing Donald Trump say that?
Horror. It was horror. What is he doing? Why is he bragging about kissing me? And I need to really step up my game on this beat. This is not a time to make friends. This is not a time to...
This was before the Access Hollywood tape was revealed. So you didn't know about that. But he did already have a reputation for behaving inappropriately around women. So did that figure into your reaction to that kiss as well?
No, I think I just put it out of my head immediately and kept going. I just chalked it up to Donald Trump being such a bizarre character. I mean, this is a guy who his mood swings were wild. On one day he would try to introduce me to a crowd and tell them how great I was as if I was his wife, or he'd call me out and say that I was doing great reporting at a rally. And then, a couple days later, a couple weeks later, he would call me a liar from the stage. I mean, he just swung back and forth between these two poles that I just chalked it up as another mood swing.
Okay, if you're just joining us, my guest is Katie Turr. She is a reporter for NBC and MSNBC, and she covered the Trump campaign for both. She has a new memoir. It's called Unbelievable, My Front Row Seat to the Craziest Campaign in American History. We'll be right back after a break. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Rhodes Scholar, a nonprofit dedicated to the belief that learning is the journey of a lifetime. Rhodes Scholar creates learning adventures around the world. Information is available at ageadventurously.org. And from Inada, creators of the Japanese-made Dreamwave massage chair with Shiatsu point detection and 16 programmed massages, including morning and nighttime sessions. Retail dealers nationwide. More at dreamwavechair.com.
Mm-hmm. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross, back with Katie Turr. Her new memoir, Unbelievable, is about her experiences covering the Trump campaign for NBC and MSNBC. She was the first national TV correspondent to cover Trump's campaign full-time. So you never expected to be covering the Trump campaign. You were an NBC correspondent based in London. You'd come to the U.S. because you were asked by a teenager through the Make-A-Wish Foundation to shadow you for a day. So you generously came to the States so that, you know, you could see him, he could shadow you. How did that lead to covering the Trump campaign?
So I came home to do that, and it was a wonderful experience. The boy's name is Aaron. He and his family are incredible people, really strong and brave people. And then when I was done doing that and when they went home, I went into the newsroom and I said hello to my bosses because I needed to remind them that I existed. When you live in an overseas bureau, you tend to get forgotten if there's not a lot of news happening. And I was literally just standing around the newsroom when business after business started dropping Donald Trump after his announcement where he talked about Mexico sending rapists into the country. And a friend of mine, Brad Jaffe, who works on Nightly News, said, Katie Turr is just standing around. She can do this. And I was just standing around. So I did a couple stories for Nightly, and I did a couple stories for the Today Show. And a few days later, the president of NBC News said, we need to have somebody on Donald Trump. Wherever this goes, we need to have a correspondent on Donald Trump. But remember, Terry, these things get planned well in advance. Political candidates get matched up to political correspondents. We know who's running and we know who's going to cover them. High profile people get high profile correspondents. Donald Trump was not a part of anyone's plan. And for that matter, neither was I. It's a political outsider in Trump. It's a political outsider in me. So they matched us together. And what they thought would have been 6 weeks, because nobody was taking Donald Trump seriously. They presumed he would eventually drop out, that it was just an attention-getting stunt. They said, hey, listen, it'll be short, and then we'll send you back to London. And I signed on saying, okay, if I hate it, at least it'll be short. And it just never ended. He was serious, and people were not laughing him off stage, as some might have expected during a presidential debate. They were cheering him on, and his poll numbers only went up and up and up and up. And I suddenly found myself on a roller coaster that I could not get off of.
I want to read the sentence that starts the prologue to your memoir about covering the campaign. And the sentence is, I'm about to throw up. And you write this just after Donald Trump clinches the election. Why were you about to throw up? And why did you start with that sentence?
I was about to throw up, not for any partisan political reason, not because I wanted somebody else to win, not because I'm a Democrat or I'm a Republican or I'm an independent. It was nothing political about it. It was this wild ride, this unreality that we're living, where facts don't matter, where nothing seems to really matter, is where we will end up living for the next 4 years. Not only that, but my embed, Ali Vitali, came up to me and said, Donald Trump is going to keep doing rallies. So I envisioned myself trapped in a press pen for the rest of my life, never able to find a real home, never able to get my life back, to sleep in my own bed, get a routine back. Not only that, not able to get anyone to trust us again.
Us being the media.
Us being the media.
You managed to land the first long interview with, television interview with Donald Trump after he announced his candidacy. And you asked him some pretty tough questions. I want to play a short excerpt of what happened. And here you are asking him about immigration.
Immigration is down. Why is this such a big topic for you right now?
Well, immigration's a very big topic. Take a look at all the crime that's being committed. Go take a look at it.
The research says the crime does not match what you're saying.
The research.
The Pew Research, which is independent, says...
Don't be naive. You're a very naive person.
The Pew Research says that there are... For immigrants on the whole,
Come on, try getting it out. Try getting it out.
I'll get it out.
I mean, I don't know if you're going to put this on television, but you don't even know what you're talking about. Try getting it out. Go ahead.
Immigrants commit less crime than U.S.-born citizens. Okay. There are less immigrants in our jails than...
You know what? Number one, I disagree with it. Number two, whether it's true or not, illegal immigrants. I'm talking about illegal immigrants. I'm not talking about immigrants. I'm talking about illegal immigrants. I'm an immigrant. You're an immigrant. We're all immigrants.
Illegal immigrants commit less crime other than coming through illegally.
I'm talking about illegal immigrants are causing tremendous crime. Tremendous crime. And nobody wants to talk about it. And that's why Fox, at least Fox, and you won't leave this perhaps, but at least Fox is being honest because they're now talking about it bigly.
So, Katie Ter, what was your reaction when Donald Trump mentioned that you had stumbled?
I remember in the moment.
I ask this as somebody who stumbles all the time.
I stumble. Listen, and if you watch me on MSNBC, you'll know that I stumble. That's who I am. So I knew that he was going to try and intimidate me. I knew he was going to try and steamroll me. And so when he said, "You're stumbling," I remember smiling and laughing a little in my head and saying, of course he's doing this, but also saying he is trying to intimidate you. So take a deep breath. And then, you know what? Yes, you will get it out. And I did.
So what was the impact of that 29-minute interview on Donald Trump and on you?
I guess it put me onto the political scene in a significant way. It was a really contentious and tense interview. I didn't realize how angry he was in the moment while I was interviewing him. I presumed it was all a part of his shtick. It was all part of this show that he has. He is a reality TV show host. He is known for the catchphrase, "You're fired." He's known for getting in people's faces. So I just thought this was him being TV's Donald Trump. When I watched it on the air alongside Chuck Todd, and I'm sitting next to NBC's political director, this is the moderator of Meet the Press, and I am nobody. And I'm watching it, and I couldn't believe how angry he actually was. He was seething. He never smiled. He was glaring at me the whole time. It was very clear that he had anticipated a much easier interview.
Your book ends with these words. Donald Trump went on to Washington. He may or may not still be there by the time you read these words. I'll add, he's still there. And then you're right. There's a pretty good case that he didn't want to go in the first place, didn't like it when he got there, and wished for a way back into his old life that didn't involve scandal or shame. Do you often wonder if Donald Trump actually wants to be president now? If he's sorry that he got into this?
I think that is a reasonable question. Absolutely. This is a guy who has never shown a lot of interest in policy or in civic service. He never ran for office, never held an elected office, was not in the military. He built a big business, but the business is mostly family run. He's been very much, his career before this was about self-promotion and self-aggrandizement. So I think it's a valid question that remains open about whether or not he truly wanted to be president. And there's a good argument to be made that he did not want to be president and that he's not having a good time while he's in office. But I think that is ultimately a question that nobody other than Donald Trump can answer.
Do you think you'll ever get to interview him again?
I certainly hope so. I do. I do.
You don't vote and because you want to be neutral, especially when you're covering a candidate. You don't want that candidate to think that you're for them or against them. You're just covering them. And voting is the right that every citizen should have. It's a private thing. You're in the voting booth. No one knows who you voted for unless you tell them. So given all that, why do you choose not to vote?
Because I don't want to color my own opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if I was voting, I would feel like I had a horse in the race. And I don't have a horse in the race. My job during this campaign season was to tell you what was going on as accurately as I could and without bias, without coloring it with a desire that I might have internally for a different outcome. And I feel very strongly about that personally. I know everyone has their own opinions on this, but I feel very strongly about it. So if I am covering politics or if I'm covering specifically a presidential race, I don't think it's appropriate to vote.
Katie Turr, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Terry, thank you. I found this to be a wonderful experience.
Katie Turr is an MSNBC anchor and a reporter for NBC. Her memoir about covering the Trump campaign is called Unbelievable. This is Fresh Air. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of Clara Massoud's new novel, The Burning Girl. Maureen says the book looks at what it's like to be young, female, and afraid.
About halfway through Clara Massoud's new novel, called The Burning Girl, our narrator, a 12-year-old girl named Julia, makes this pronouncement. Sometimes, Julia says, I felt that growing up and being a girl was about learning to be afraid. Not paranoid exactly, but always alert and aware, like checking out the exits in the movie theater or the fire escape in a hotel. You came to know, in a way you hadn't as a kid, that the body you inhabited was vulnerable, imperfectly fortified. Like most such pronouncements, this one can be picked apart and qualified, but within the tight confines of Massoud's novel, the grim truth of Julia's words is indisputable. The Burning Girl reads like an updated Gothic tale, in part because it has so many of the traditional trappings of the genre, a decaying mansion, an evil guardian, and ghosts, and in part because it's a novel about the friendship between two adolescent girls. And what life journey could be more Gothic than the passage through adolescence? Julia and her best friend Cassie have been inseparable since they met in nursery school in their small Massachusetts town. Julia's parents are college-educated professionals. Cassie's mother is a hospice nurse. She doesn't know her dad. In the giddy fog of childhood, the girls' different class backgrounds and family situations don't matter until adolescence hits, and then everything begins to matter. Looking back, Julia recalls how, during the crucial summer before seventh grade, she and Cassie are emboldened to walk far afield from town on adventures. They swim in an abandoned quarry pool, where, as legend has it, a teenager back in the 1980s dived in and never surfaced again. They wander deep into the woods and break into a decrepit mansion that had once been a women's asylum. Inside, the decor is straight out of Charlotte Perkins Gilman's Gothic feminist short story, The Yellow Wallpaper. Empty cells with metal bedsteads, blooming mold on the walls in shades of orange, watermelon, and lime. All this place lacks is a resident madwoman, but it won't have to wait for long. Because Massoud is such a precise and restrained writer, the girl's haunted summer walking tour remains credible as well as evocative. For instance, she shows Julia struggling to find just the right word to describe the color of the boulders in the quarry. Not gold exactly, but tawny, like a lion. And she characterizes the gloom inside the asylum's common room as being hazed with dust. But it's when Julia and Cassie enter the world of seventh grade, a time when things naturally get weird, that Massoud reminds us readers what a psychologically deft writer she is and how powerfully she can communicate emotions without spelling them out. Cassie begins to pull away from Julia. She becomes friends with girls who wear push-up bras and makeup, and she starts sneaking off to boy-girl parties. The fading away of the friendship is performed in pantomime. Neither Julia nor Cassie speaks a word to each other about what's going on. Instead, as Julia recalls, we step through the looking glass into a world all of fake friendliness. I had other friends, but I'd lost the friend I loved best and had loved without thinking for as long as I could remember. and it seemed absolutely essential not to appear to care. A lot more happens in The Burning Girl, but overall, this is a novel that's made distinct by its mood more than its story. The climax here melds together the mundane griefs and cruelties of adolescence with the eerie atmosphere of those dark woods and that asylum. Like most of Masood's other novels, The Burning Girl deeply excavates the subject of female loneliness. Growing up female, as Julia tells us, may indeed have something to do with learning to be afraid. But in writing on the difficult topics of abandonment, betrayal, and isolation, Masood herself is fearless.
Marin Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Burning Girl by Clara Masood. Coming up, jazz pianist and composer Fred Hirsch. We'll talk about what it was like to start his jazz career in the closet and then, nearly 30 years ago, come out as gay and as having HIV. He has a new memoir. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. You could almost say my guest Fred Hirsch returned from the dead. He's a jazz musician and composer who has had HIV for more than 30 years. The diagnosis came at a time when he was thinking he was ready to come out. It's hard to think of another jazz musician who was out at the time. Hirsch's new memoir, Good Things Happen Slowly, is about what it was like to be closeted in the jazz world and then come out as gay and as having AIDS. There's been periods of his life when he's been very sick. The worst was in 2008, when in the hope of keeping him alive, doctors put him in a medically induced coma for 7 weeks. When he emerged, he couldn't walk, talk, eat, or lift an arm. He made a slow but remarkable comeback and was able to return to composing and performing. Hirsch has twice been voted Jazz Pianist of the Year by the Jazz Journalists Association. He teaches at Rutgers University and formerly taught at the New England Conservatory. In addition to his new memoir, he has a new album called Open Book. It includes him playing Monk's composition, RNL. Fred Hirsch, welcome back to Fresh Air. I love the way your memoir starts, because it's such a great example of the unusual position you were in early in your career as a closeted jazz musician. You were playing in the pit band of a theater in what sounds like a theme park, a park with a fake Eiffel Tower and lots of rides. And so the show that you were playing piano in was called Hitland USA, and it was covers of mainstream pop hits. And you write about the difference between the singers in the show and the members of the band. Describe the difference for us.
Well, most of the singers were students or graduates of the local Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music, which has a very fine music theater program. The musicians in the pit were mostly local jazz musicians or high school music teachers. You know, they were talking about Cincinnati Reds and Cars, and then the gay guys in the show were lip-syncing to Judy Garland and Bette Midler and being very catty with each other. It was really quite a conundrum. Like, I know that I'm not this, but I know that I'm not that either. And I think that was something that played out in my life for many years afterwards.
Right, so you weren't lip-syncing to Judy Garland records at the same time you weren't obsessed with Cars and Girls, like like the members
of the
band.
Yeah, I'm probably the only gay guy who's never owned a Barbra Streisand record.
So did you feel like you should try to fit in one side or the other?
I'd say that I was more interested in fitting in with the jazz guys because that was my passion. Given the way that I developed as a young musician, as an improviser and a composer at a very young age, jazz was pretty much an ideal use of the skill set that I felt I had. And the jazz culture was really a subculture. It was, you know, little clubs and no money and kind of kooky jazz fans and, you know, interesting variety of musicians, ages, races, levels of ability. But I felt like it was this really cool club that I wanted to belong to.
So how did you discover jazz? You'd been playing in pit bands, in, you know, choruses, stuff like that, pop tunes.
Well, we had a high school jazz ensemble, which I played with, and I went away to liberal arts school at Grinnell College in Iowa, and I had a piano teacher and a couple of friends who were into jazz. I started listening to records, buying books, going to the college record store, learning about the music. And I was back in Cincinnati, and I stumbled into this little jazz club called the Family Owl. And I heard this wonderful tenor saxophone player playing with a quartet. And I, for some reason, thought that I would be able to sit in with them. So I said, can I play a tune? And he said, what do you know? I said, I think I can play Autumn Leaves. So I played Autumn Leaves and didn't play it very well. I don't think I had a great mastery of rhythm at that point in my life. And after that performance, the tenor saxophonist, a little guy named Jimmy McGarry, took me to the back room, and he played me a Duke Ellington record live at Newport that has a track, Diminuendo and Crescendo in Blue, on which the great tenor saxophonist Paul Gonsalves plays 26 choruses of blues, and people are going crazy. It's hysteria. The excitement is building with every chorus. And he took the needle off at the end of the track and said, that's time. And once you get your time together and learn some tunes, you can come back. So with nobody to guide me, as I had no gay role models, I had no role models in the jazz world either, I went to the local used record shop and I bought 12 or 13 albums that had Autumn Leaves on them and listened to them all and realized that they were all great. None of them was the best. They were all personal, different interpretations. And I realized that, you know, maybe this is a music where I can really be an individual.
So you go to New York, you start playing in clubs, including Bradley's, which was famous for having pianists perform there. And you were reviewed by Whitney Balliot there, who described you as a slender, bearded, light-fingered poet of a pianist. Beautiful, like so quotable, perfect blur.
Yes.
Except you were worried about the light-fingered part because light is also used in the expression light in the loafers, which is a kind of derisive word. It was a derisive phrase for describing somebody who was gay. So you didn't know how to take it. You weren't sure if he was kind of subtly implying in a derogatory way that you were gay.
This is something that, you know, has been a thing in my whole career that's taken me many years to resolve. People will come up to me after concerts and say, wow, you sounded beautiful. And for so many years, I wanted to hear something else. I wanted to hear, you know, that I was swinging or that I was doing this, that, and the other. But beauty in music and lyricism may be things that I had internalized as coded for gay. Like when I get a review that says elegant or lyrical, I mean, I have to agree that that is sort of how I play. And I do have a particular touch, whether you call it light or whatever, but it is my sound for sure. It took me many years to get over trying to prove myself that I could do these other hard swinging kinds of rhythmically challenging things too, and for people to give me the props for being able to do that. as well as play lyrically and beautifully.
You write that your life, once you really got into jazz, your life revolved around the music and around getting high, which at the time seemed all of a piece to you. What were the ways in which they seemed connected? And we're talking about the early 1970s here?
Yeah, we're talking about 73, 74-ish, early 75. Well, I was, you know, born in 55 and discovered pot and all of that when I was about a 9th or 10th grader in 71 or 72. And I found that weed was really an ideal drug for listening. It helped focus my hearing. It's a terrible performance drug, but it was really good for listening. So there were a couple of older jazz musicians, maybe 4 or 5 years older than I, who had amazing vinyls. They had just all these great jazz records and great weed. So I would spend, you know, most evenings or after the gig that I might be doing with these guys, just sitting around till all hours, just getting high and playing sides. And then the next day I would sit at my piano and just try to, you know, channel some of the pianists that I loved, you know, kind of inexactly imitating them.
There's a scene in your book where you describe getting high with the great trumpeter and singer Chet Baker. And this is about heroin. Like, he's shooting up, you're snorting it. And I'm thinking, as I'm reading this, did Chet Baker, who had been addicted for a fair amount of his adult life, did he have any idea that you, this young musician, had never done heroin before and that you risked becoming an addict at that moment? I mean, what was the sense, if any, that the older jazz musicians had about protecting younger people from becoming addicted?
Honestly, I don't think they had any sense about it. When I started playing in bands, particularly with Joe Henderson, I felt like as the, you know, junior cat in the band, I should always bring a little bit of coke for Joe to have, just as a, you know, kind of as a nice gesture as the new guy on the team. But I don't think Chet Baker really thought too much about his behavior and how it affected anyone. The only person who ever said anything to me, oddly enough, was Jimmy McGarry back in Cincinnati. And he took me aside one night and he said, "Look, whatever you want to do after the gig, get high, get drunk, do what you want, but don't bring it on the bandstand because you're going to end up like me." He said, "I could have gone to New York. I might have made something of myself, but I've got a drinking problem, and I think you should really separate your drug use from what you do on the bandstand."
And that was helpful to hear that from him.
Yeah, I've never, ever had a drink and gotten on stage.
Did you ever use heroin again?
Nope. That was one and only.
Your first long-term boyfriend, you were still trying to establish yourself as a jazz musician at that time, and you were still in the closet, and you felt like you had to hide the relationship. How do you do that? How do you hide a relationship? Like, you tell a great story. You tell this on our show years ago, but I'm going to ask you to tell it again about you were playing with Stan Getz at the time. He came over to your apartment to rehearse, and you realized, what did you realize?
I realized that there were two toothbrushes in the bathroom, one for me and one for Eric. And as Stan was walking down the hall into my loft, I went and I hid Eric's toothbrush because I thought, oh, if he notices two toothbrushes, he'll think, oh, maybe there's somebody else here. I mean, it was just completely insane. And when he left, I kind of went back in and sort of looked at the bathroom, and I said, you know, that was my first inkling that, you know, this has got to stop. Like, he is the great Stan Getz, and I admire him for his amazing musicianship, but, you know, if he has a problem with me being gay, well, then it's his problem, and it's not my problem. So that was just the beginning of thinking, you know, maybe there's a way to integrate all this and not be so secretive.
That does not mean that you came out to Stan Getz, right?
No, I did not come out to Stan Getz, no.
When did you start coming out?
Well, I think it's a you know, most people will tell you it's a process. I think there are sort of three stages of coming out. The one stage is when you tell your first person. And that's, you know, you're waiting for the perfect time and just the right person and just the right words to say, you know, to say that you're gay and you don't know how it's going to go and you're nervous. And the second stage is when you assume that everybody knows and nobody cares. And then the third stage is that, you know, when somebody talks about their wife or girlfriend or children, you talk about your partner. And it's just a total non-issue. And I did tell my parents very early on after I'd moved to Boston. I was 19, I told them. And friends of mine, of course, knew. But I didn't really come out in the huge way that I did in the public until 1993 in association with a benefit project I did for an AIDS services organization. And that became quite a large story. I think we may have even talked at that time.
We did.
And I was talking not only about being a gay jazz musician, but being an artist or musician with HIV, which at that point was a death sentence, really.
Yeah, and to my knowledge, you were the first jazz musician to come out and take an activist position about it and to take an activist position about HIV.
I'd say that that's probably true because I felt like, okay, how many more years do I have left? You know, maybe by being out and continuing to just do what I do kind of with a vengeance, as if my life depended on it, which it sort of did, maybe I can help somebody else who's struggling with whether or not to come out. There were some horror stories, friends of mine who had HIV that said, oh, when I get sick, my family will take care of me. And then, in fact, their families disowned them. And I really felt that you needed to be out about who you are as a person and what you're dealing with so that you know when the chips are down, who's going to be there for you. And don't assume that it's going to be your biological family.
Fred, how is your health now?
Thank you for asking. My health now is better than it was 25 years ago. I'm doing absolutely great. I do take more than 30 pills a day. I have to do some insulin every night, but I have plenty of energy. I'm touring a lot. I have a lot of great musical opportunities. It's really kind of surprised me how well I'm doing, and even factoring in the fact that I'm pushing the senior citizen status, I feel much, much younger. I feel I'm getting better at what I do in some ways, and I'm just looking forward to the next thing, whatever that is, the next project.
I'm really glad to hear that you're doing well, and that's a nice note to end on. Fred Hirsch, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Fred Hirsch is the author of the new memoir, Good Things Happen Slowly, and has a new album called Open Book.